We at the Brennan Center work on a whole host of issues, but central to our work, and something that we know Justice Brennan would approve of, or maybe does approve of, is our work on justice itself, on making sure that our criminal justice system serves the people, does not discriminate, does not magnify racial injustice, and reflects our constitutional values. And we believe at the Brennan Center, as so many people now, from all across the political spectrum, have come to believe that mass incarceration is a moral challenge for the country, it is a racial justice challenge for the country, and it isn't necessary to keep our country safe. It's a very, very varied challenge. It's a very multifaceted issue. But we're very proud to have a justice program at the Brennan Center that has become a leading force, a leading voice on this issue in innovative and creative ways, using tools of economics, aligning with law enforcement and tapping their expertise, reaching out to communities, all the ways that we need to reach out to address this issue. That's the topic of this conversation today. And on a note of personal privilege for those of us at the Brennan Center, we have really a remarkable group of people to talk about it, but one in particular we want to brag on. Lauren Brooke Eisen, which is apparently her full name, we know her as LB, is a senior counsel at the Brennan Center in our justice program. She did a remarkable job on this book, Inside Private Prisons, that has just been released. She did this while working on everything else that we asked her to work on, all the other legal and policy work. Along with her colleagues in the justice program, she's brought economic analysis and a sense of the incentives that can drive mass incarceration and maybe can drive a better way. So we're very, very, very proud of you, LB. I said to, I think, your father that he was the second proudest person here. And I want to hand the mic over, where am I, to Ilse Chang. Before I do that, I want to thank the people at the Brennan Center who made this event possible. We have now a series of public events this fall at a moment of incredible public attention and passion about these issues, and about all these issues. Our colleagues, Janine Plant-Cherlin, Melanie O'Keefe, Elizabeth Marr, and Jessica Katzen, are making something new in New York City that is really serious and really exciting and is getting standing room only crowds even in the middle of hurricane private prison. I want to thank you all. And I want to thank you, Ilse. Ilse Chang is a correspondent on Planet Money, on NPR, star of radio, star of podcasts, and somebody who is part of the new wave of innovation in radio that is redefining how we communicate with each other. And we're really grateful to you for being part of this and for being here.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I was just telling some folks downstairs that I think it's so cool that the Brennan Center is this place that gives space for its members to pursue these passion projects. For it took 3 years of research, 1 year of intense writing, something like that. And you really were, you would put in full days at work and then would continue to write when you got home.
Well, I wrote at work as well.
Even more kudos to the Brennan Center for giving you that space. So I think that's super cool. I am absolutely thrilled to be here. I am at Planet Money podcast right now, which has been great because for me, it's my first foray in long-form storytelling in radio. But as a former lawyer, you know, even though Planet Money is teaching me how to think about economics in a different way, to learn a lot about economics, I'm finding all these ways to go back and tell stories about our legal system, about criminal justice issues, because I'm still so fascinated by that, those realm of stories. I started my reporting career as a criminal justice reporter at WNYC here in New York, and I never gave up that sort of fixation on how our justice system works. So I was especially ecstatic when you and Melon approached me to moderate this panel. So thank you all for making it out here. Welcome. I believe we are podcasting, right, this event as we speak. So I just want to give a shout out to our podcast listeners. You can catch this event at brennancenter.org. Also, be sure to catch other podcasts and videos from the Brennan Center on iTunes and YouTube. And you can follow the Brennan Center's work on Facebook and Twitter. So let's get to it. As you all know, this is going to be a very focused, intense conversation about the private prison system in the United States. Hundreds of thousands of people enter into this private prison system and private immigration detention centers across the country. And it's a system that makes people a lot of money, some $5 billion a year. So private prisons, as you can imagine, have become a key focus for the movement against mass incarceration. And the Department of Justice under President Obama made some moves to try to decrease our country's reliance on private prisons, on private prisons. But under the Trump administration, the Justice Department seems to be reversing some of those efforts. So that brings us to the question, if the private prison system is to stay, and it's to stay robust in this country, how can it be improved? That's something we're going to talk about tonight. And we have a terrific panel of speakers that I will introduce right now. Eli Hager, over there on the very end, is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the criminal justice system. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, and many, many other places. Eric Schlosser, next to him, is an investigative journalist and the author of many books. I'm sure you've heard of these titles, Fast Food Nation and Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and The Illusion of Safety. Schlosser's next book, The Great Imprisonment, delves into a lot of what we're going to be talking about today, into how the U.S. came to have the largest prison system in the world. Next, we have, obviously, Lauren Brooke Eisen, who goes by LB. I'll be calling you LB tonight. She's a senior counsel for the Justice Program at the Brennan Center. She is also the author of the book we'll be talking a lot about tonight called Inside Private Prisons. She was given unprecedented access to the private prison system to write that book, and she will be sharing a lot about what she discovered in those 3 years that she spent researching this. And finally, Khalil Cumberbatch is the Associate Vice President of Policy for the Fortune Society. Khalil actually spent, correct me if I'm wrong, 6.5 years in prison. And now he spends his time helping other former inmates with reentry. The Fortune Society also talks about alternatives to incarceration. So welcome to all of you. This is fantastic to have you all here. Eric, I want to just start with you first. About 20 years ago, you wrote what a lot of people regard as this seminal article for The Atlantic called The Prison Industrial Complex. It was a story that examined how closely connected capitalism is to the correction system. And you've been credited with coining a phrase that we toss around a lot. It's the title of that article, The Prison Industrial Complex. I guess if you could just start us out, what did you mean by that phrase, the prison industrial complex?
Well, I won't take credit for coining the phrase. It was a phrase that was sort of being used and had been out there for a year or two. But I tried to figure out, does such a thing exist? And if it does, how would you describe it? And for me, the prison industrial complex is a set of political, bureaucratic, and economic forces that combine to push for incarceration, whether we need it as a society or not. And I try to analyze, well, what groups and what special interest groups were pushing for more prisons? Politicians who were using fear of crime to get elected. Bureaucracies like correctional bureaus and prosecutors who had a vested interest in growing their own bureaucracies. Rural areas that were economically deprived, for whom prisons were the only form of economic development that was going on in many cases in the 80s and 90s. And then you have corporations who, at the end of, once the Cold War had ended, there were a lot of companies that were looking for new areas of growth, particularly in construction, and then the private prison companies. So how is it that the land of the free got the biggest prison system in the history of the world, And in writing about the prison industrial complex, it's not a conspiracy, in my view. It's not a group of people operating behind closed doors. It's just special interests that took hold of this subject for their own benefit and not for our benefit.
In 1998, when you first wrote that article for The Atlantic, we, as a country, hadn't seen yet the levels of mass incarceration that we now see today.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what do you think has changed? How have economic incentives maybe have changed to contribute to the boost in prison populations that we see today?
Yeah. You know, it was happening then, and I'm very gratified that it seems to have plateaued, but it's plateaued at an extraordinarily high level. There's often the statistic that there's 2.2 million people roughly behind bars, but there's an additional 12 million people who will be locked up every year because the jails especially are just this revolving door. Now, some of those 12 million are the same people getting locked up again and again, but this is a really unnatural thing, and somehow we've gotten used to it, and particularly for middle America and for opinion makers, you know, most middle Americans don't know anyone who's in prison because the prison industry and the prison industrial complex has basically been feeding off of the poor and people of color and people who are mentally ill and drug addicted. I mean, the most vulnerable members of society are the source of profits for the prison industrial complex. So the Marshall Project and so many organizations now are trying to bring attention to mass incarceration, but for years and years it was hidden away, and it was something that nobody really cared about because a lot of money was being made.
Colby, your book looks specifically at how private prisons played a role in mass incarceration. How did the private prison system actually directly boost the populations that we see in prisons today?
Well, as Eric mentioned, there's this sort of vast prison industrial complex that's even bigger than the industry that runs and operates these prisons. But what happened in the mid-1980s was that about 3/4 of states were under some sort of federal court order to reduce their prison populations due to unconstitutional conditions. So prisons were overcrowded, they were unsafe, they were unhygienic, they were bursting at the seams. And policymakers didn't know what to do. State policymakers, federal policymakers, and they were sort of at this moment of, you know, how do we raise taxes to build more prisons? We're gonna have to issue bonds, but we have to repair tough on crime, but nobody wants to pay taxes. And the private prison corporation emerged in terms of these corporations that actually operate prisons. Mm-hmm. And the first one on the scene was Corrections Corporation of America. It's now rebranded as CoreCivic. And I think what happened in Tennessee is a really great sort of moment, a storytelling moment. So in 1985, Tennessee was one of those states where the prisons were overcrowded, there were riots, there were escapes, and Corrections Corporation of America made an offer to the state of Tennessee, and they said, for $250 million, we will run, we will take over your entire prison system for a 99-year lease. And it was a pretty unprecedented offer at the time, and Tennessee ultimately rejected the offer. There was an article in the Chicago Tribune in 1985 at the time that I think was very prescient, and said nobody knew whether the lobbyists for Corrections Corporation of America running around the Capitol that day were cavalry coming to the rescue or profiteers coming to exploit. Yeah. And I think that sort of phrase, that quote, just says so much about the three decades of the private prison industry where we haven't asked enough questions, and that moment let policymakers off the hook. So they didn't have to ask the tough questions of, do we have too many people incarcerated? Are we sending too many people to jails and prisons who violate our criminal code? Are there alternatives to incarceration? that would make more sense and that would be less costly. And that was a moment that the country, sort of a turning point, where we headed down towards this path of mass incarceration because the private prison industry sort of let everyone off the hook.
Right, they didn't have to solve the hard problems.
Right, they could build these prisons quickly, cheaply, and we just outsourced our overflow of incarcerated individuals. And I think since then, we have let the private prison industry, you know, we were talking before this panel, become entrenched in corrections. And it didn't have to be that way, but that's what our policymakers and that's what our directors of corrections have sort of let happen. So we're at this time now where the private prison industry is entrenched in state corrections at the federal level, and maybe even more significantly because of what's happening under the Trump administration, about 65% of beds in immigration detention centers are run by the private sector. So we've essentially outsourced immigration detention in this country, and we're going to see more and more of that under this administration.
And as we see the private prison system grow or stay robust, one of the problems that you identify in the book is you don't see really good, strong programming in these prisons to help reduce recidivism rates. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, that you actually see less programming in private prisons than you do in state prisons. Programming is just less of a priority.
And that's purposeful, because what we've done is we've almost given the private prison industry, it is a little unfair. We've said, you need to save us money, but continue to, you know, provide programming and, you know, just be a government partner. But what happens is these private prisons will cut costs, so they'll cut corrections officers and they will cut programming in order to make a profit. They're for-profit industries. And when I visited a lot of these private prisons for the book, there is less programming. There tend to be less correctional officers. And a lot of the people I spoke to said, well, I'm being left alone and people aren't on my back the same way, but you know, when I talk to a lot of the incarcerated individuals in these prisons, a lot of them wanted to be in state prisons where they had more programming. They wanted to learn skills that would help them for reentry, and a lot of them were actually asking to go back to the government, you know, run prison just so they could get into the reentry programs. So that is it's a severe problem, and then in terms of immigration detention, there's no programming. Almost none.
I'll return to this topic again, but I'm just curious about first thoughts. How do you incentivize private prisons to provide programming when they also are under the same pressure to cut costs? Mm-hmm. Is there a way to do that?
And that's a great question, and something that I certainly wrestled with in terms of writing the book. In order to suggest reforms, we have to ask the questions of, you know, there's a movement to abolish private prisons in this country, and you know, a lot of people think, is it just? Is it fair to profit off of incarceration? But while this wider debate ranges, I think it's incumbent on government to hold corporations' feet to the fire a little bit more and say, as long as you are operating these facilities, you need to reduce recidivism rates. You need to improve your programming. And so far, we haven't seen that. We haven't seen government write these tight contracts requiring more programming, requiring, you know, the government's recidivism rate is 75%, about 3/4 of people who are released from prison return to prison within 3 years. Government's doing a terrible job of rehabilitating people who are behind bars. We really need to ask the private sector to do better.
Eli, you kind of have an interesting vantage point into the private prison system. A lot of your journalism has revealed some horrible conditions that exist in the private transport system that services both private and public prisons. And there's one piece you wrote where I'm going to quote, I mean, this is just such an interesting quote. You wrote, "The conditions were so deplorable that at one point, the prisoners on the bus all scribbled down their contact information on a fast food wrapper, hoping to reconnect later to sue the owner of the bus, Prisoner Transportation Services, which is the nation's largest for-profit extradition company." Can you just describe to people what you found? How bad were these conditions these are buses, I'm imagining?
Buses and 15-passenger vans. That's right. So one of the things we've been trying to do with the Marshall Project is look at some of the other sectors of the prison industrial complex that have been privatized. So it's not just private prisons. Commissary goods at prisons are privatized, and food services and medical services and phone services for people in prison to call home. And one of the industries that we found that hadn't been covered that much in the media was this private prisoner transport industry. And these are, as you said, buses and 15-passenger vans that ferry people across the country to go face arrest warrants in other states. And they often are on these 7-day, 10-day, 14-day journeys, individual people, because they zigzag all around the country trying to pick up other people at other jails along the way, because that's the cost incentives are such that you want to make really good time and you want to pack the vans with as many people as possible. So the conditions we found on a bus like that one were that individual people would be, on the bus for 10 or 14 days, they'd be handcuffed at their waist and ankles. They'd be sitting upright the whole time, no way to sleep. They would never stop because the buses want to keep going to make more money. And so they often would have to urinate or defecate on the floor of the vehicle. They wouldn't be provided food and water all that often. They didn't have seatbelts, so they would careen around like pinballs because they were locked up like that. Women would be seated next to men. And there was, we found over a dozen sexual assaults likely because of that on these vans and buses. And also people who were accused of murder were seated next to people who were facing non-payment of child support or probation violations, and everybody was just in there together. So these are the kinds of conditions that we found on the vehicles. And as a result of those conditions, we identified over 60 crashes on these vehicles, causing a dozen deaths. Because, as I said before, the incentive structure is such that these companies want to speed, they want to make really good time. And we also found over 50 escapes because the guards aren't trained, because they're not paid very well, and they didn't know how to take care of, people on the vans. And we also found, just in the past few years, 5 deaths of people on vans or buses operated by this one company, Prisoner Transportation Services, because oftentimes they have a medical condition, but it would go neglected for the 5 or 7 days while they were on there. They had medication they were supposed to get, and the company didn't give it to them while they were on the bus. So these were all the conditions that we found, and they were pretty much all the direct result of the companies wanting to shave time and make money, because the faster they went, the more money, the more pickups they could make, the more people they jammed on there, the more pickups they could make, and the less attention they paid to buying food and water and stopping for bathrooms, the more money they could make. So it was kind of all arising out of that.
Did you get a sense that any lawmakers, either state or federal lawmakers, are hoping to make changes? Was, like, as a result of your reporting, did that do anything?
Right, so actually the week after our story was published, then Attorney General Loretta Lynch went before a Judiciary Committee hearing on Capitol Hill and was asked by a congressperson about our article and about whether the Justice Department would look into this industry, particularly because a law was actually passed in 2000 that set some broad guidelines for these companies. That law has only been enforced by the Justice Department once, despite all those crashes and escapes and abuses and deaths that I was listening to before. And so the congressman asked Loretta Lynch whether the Justice Department would do anything about it, and she said she was launching an investigation. And we do know that the Justice Department, in the months following that, called a number of the victims and victims' families that we had written about in our article. They were doing an initial investigation. Obviously, a lot of the DOJ attorneys who were working on that, they may still be in the Justice Department, but some of the priorities of the Justice Department, especially the Civil Rights Division, have changed after the new administration took power. So it's not clear whether that investigation is being continued, but we do know that there was some response from the Justice Department.
Khalil, you were not in a private prison, right? When you spent the 6.5 years? Okay. Yep. But part of what you do now is you work very closely with inmates who have been in private prison. Can you tell us what are problems that have been identified by people you work with who have spent years in private prisons, problems that you think are specific to private prisons?
Yeah, so thank you, first of all, to the Brennan Center for having me, and LB, congratulations on your book. So I think when we hear the term private prison, I think most people are kind of taken aback. I think most people are aghast at the fact that there is this profiteering wing of this issue that we now call mass incarceration. And so undoubtedly there are issues with transportation, and undoubtedly there are issues with the conditions that exist in some of these prisons and jails. But I would be remiss if I didn't say that private prisons are really the symptom of the deeper need to have capitalism guide this idea of justice. And what that means is that most people will hear private prisons and they will be confused and say, why is it that someone is serving a sentence that was given to them by a local or state government or federal government, they're serving it in a private entity? And so most people kind of like are preaching to the choir in that respect. But I think the most devious parts of the privatization of this entire system comes with things like ankle monitors. A recommendation that many people would hear and they would say, oh, that really does make sense. You know, like, we don't want someone in a jail cell or a prison cell, so why not confine them to the community but give them an ankle bracelet? But the reality is that that ankle bracelet comes at a cost to the individual, an individual that all too often committed an act that came from the fact that they did not have certain socioeconomic access. And so now you're putting more restriction on an individual who many would argue, including myself, should not have been given many restrictions in the first place to give them the lesser of two evils to choose from. And so what I'm saying is that private prisons, while a very important part of this conversation, I don't want it to get lost on the audience and to the folks watching and listening, that we're really talking about an entrenched ideology. Because, and so to give you another example, you're right, I didn't spend time in a private prison. I spent time in the New York State Correctional Facility. And so that is one that is ran by government employees, people who work for the state. But most people know that correction officers make the huge chunk of their salary on overtime. Right? And so their base salary is not necessarily enough to provide a living wage for themselves and their families. And so what they do is they work tremendous amount of hours, and as we know with anything, as Eli can attest to in his reporting, that when you overwork someone and you exert them and you don't give them access to things like food and sleep, that they become groggy, they become aggravated, and so their temper is more quick to actually anger. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen this all too often in a public setting, in a public prison, but yet the ideology of capitalism is deeply entrenched in that entire system. And so therefore the effects of that are sometimes the same exact issues that we see in private prisons, where you have correctional officers overworked.
Is it
they're
worse
violating
private prisons? I mean, this just isolating this one problem, overwork, people who are working way too many hours in a row, is that something you see more in the private prison system, the same? I mean, do you have a sense, or is it hard to...
So I think that the issue exists more undoubtedly in private prisons. And the reason why is because, as we know, with a profit motive, it's always about driving down the overhead cost that you put forth, therefore to maximize your profits. And so if a part of driving down that overhead cost is to limit the amount or to completely eliminate the amount of training that your staff would get before you actually put them in the field, then that's exactly what happens. And so what happens is most correctional officers won't have the training or the wherewithal or even the experience in many respects to treat people like human beings. They may what limited training they do get, they may even be told to treat people the opposite of that. And so, yes, the issue is more existent in private prisons. But again, I would be remiss if I was not an advocate tonight and say that those same conditions do exist in public settings, and that prisons, while they do have those conditions, that we see a lot of those issues in jails across the country. And so there is a distinction to make between prisons and jails.
One of the stated goals of our correction system is to rehabilitate and to prepare people for life after prison. Again, just speaking about private prisons specifically, what can the system do better to prepare incarcerated individuals for life outside of prison? Is there something that you would want the private prison system to focus on?
I think humanizing individuals in general is probably the most underutilized aspect of this entire thing. And so, for example, the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, under the previous administration, said that they wouldn't use the terms inmate or convict or felon when referring to people that they are serving.
Oh, so I shouldn't use the word inmate. I didn't realize that.
No, what I'm saying... You definitely should not. I'm not going to wordsmith what you're saying, but what I'm saying is that if the U.S. Department of Justice said that because, and their exact reasoning, and it came from Loretta Lynch herself, was that they understand that those terms come with connotation that is not positive, and more importantly, it only perpetuates a stigma about the people that we're talking about. So when we talk about conditions in these facilities, it's hard for people to understand that, yes, we are talking about someone who may have committed a felony, because surprise, surprise, there are also innocent people in jails and prisons. And so we are talking about someone who may or may not have committed a felony, that in the end, we're still talking about human beings who are going to return to the same society that we are a part of. And so it is our vested interest to not stigmatize them from the time that they are incarcerated. And so I think using human terminology is probably, you know, a very immeasurable way to track progress. But nevertheless, can you imagine how it feels as someone who is incarcerated? I know I can't speak personally about being acknowledged as a human being as opposed to a number or a conviction type. And so, for example, as opposed to me, because I was convicted for robbery in the first degree, and so instead of someone referring to me as an inmate or a convict or a felon or a robber or a thief, referring to me as a human being by my name, by my first name, acknowledging that while this is a part of my life, that I'm actually a whole human being, and as a human being, I'm capable of making mistakes. I think that is something that would speak volumes to any system in general, whether it's the criminal justice system or the education system, about how we speak about the individuals that we're here to serve.
Okay. So just from my own information, when I refer to someone who is now currently serving a sentence in prison, do I say incarcerated individuals?
Yeah. Incarcerated individuals, okay. Individual, human being, man, women, person who is serving time, person who's been convicted of a crime, person who has been convicted of an offense that forces them to register. There's different terminologies, but irregardless of whatever you use, that you do start with human-centered language, because it does shift the perception.
Yeah, I can see that. All right, so I will start trying that as we speak tonight. Eric and LB, I know that you guys have debated whether there is even room in our society for private prisons. I'm curious, what is your take, Eric? Should we just eradicate the whole private prison system and not even focus on how to improve it? If we could have our way.
I'll get back to your earlier question about rehabilitation.
Yeah.
I think the best way to help people out who have violated the law is not to send them to prison in the first place. Prison is not a good place to help people change their lives. Prison is effective for keeping some people away from other people. But when you look at the range of behavioral issues, whether it's substance abuse, whether it's mental health problems, prisons are not good places to be. And so huge de-incarceration is important and essential if you really want to rehabilitate people. I oppose all private prisons. Mm-hmm. I want to just throw in a little historical note because my background academically is history. When the private prison industry arose in the 1980s, they presented private prisons as this new, innovative, great new idea that would rely on market forces. And the reality is that most of 19th century corrections in one way or another, had to do with private companies. In the North, in New York State, people who were in prison were handed over to private companies to work in factories. In the South, after the Civil War, African Americans were leased out to corporations, and there's a wonderful book on that subject called Worse Than Slavery, because the conditions under convict leasing were worse than slavery. And I also think it's really important that for African Americans, up until the Civil War, the criminal justice system was entirely privatized. And, you know, punishment was meted out by the slave owner. Without any, you know, lawyers, it was... So in the early 20th century, there was a movement away from allowing private interests and corporations in the criminal justice system because of a century of incredible abuses. So the notion that privatized corrections is a new and wonderful idea is really an ahistorical argument. And there's no question that there are some private prisons right now in the United States where the conditions are better than in some public prisons. But that's really a condemnation of the public prisons and not an argument that the private prisons have done a good job. As it was said, I mean, private prisons make their money by cutting the wages of their staff. There are some private prison officers who are earning $8 an hour, wow, just above minimum wage. And it's hugely disrespectful to people who go into the criminal justice system with notions of public service. And I've met all kinds of administrators and wardens and officers who genuinely care about their work and aren't there just to make money. And it's hugely disrespectful to their public service to argue that a private company is going to do it better. What the private companies do much better is paying their executives extraordinarily high salaries. And, you know, there's a head of a private prison company that has his own corporate jet, where he flies politicians around this country on his corporate jet, and somehow there's something wrong about earning that money, as I said earlier, off the poorest, weakest, most vulnerable people in this society.
What about you, LB? Do you think there is place in our country for a private prison system? Or like Eric, do you think that there's something just completely antithetical about a profit movement, a profit motive, and a correction system?
So, in the book, the book looks at the human element of incarceration, and as Eric said, we have 2.2 million people incarcerated. Everyone in this room knows we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners, and we incarcerate more people than anyone else on the planet. Jeremy Travis is in the room who issued a wonderful report looking at the causes and consequences of mass incarceration. And, you know, it's because of our policies. It's not because the people in the United States violate the criminal code more than in other countries. We have a system of mass incarceration in this country, and the real problem with private prisons, we can compare conditions of confinement, we can compare cost savings, all of that. In the book, after doing all of this research, I found that it is a huge, significant barrier to de-incarceration in this country. And for the people in this room and across the country who are serious about reducing our prison populations, who think that prisons are not the right place for so many who violate our criminal code, the private prison industry and the vast prison industrial complex, I'm talking about JPay, that, you know, Apple of the prison system, and Aramark that provides the food, and these private healthcare companies and the video conferencing companies that charge $10 so someone can visit their family on video visitation. All of these companies are making so much money off of incarceration that it is almost virtually impossible to eradicate mass incarceration because the profit motive is so entrenched in our system of mass incarceration. And that is significant. And the book does make recommendations for how to improve conditions of confinement, how to improve transparency, how to actually require corporations to reduce recidivism rates. But that's in a world where, like today, we have private prisons. We know we can't snap our fingers. They will not go away tomorrow. The Trump administration is signing new contracts for private companies to build, run, operate immigration detention centers. While we have the private prison industry, the onus is on us and the government to improve the conditions of confinement and make those people's lives better. But if we're talking about reducing mass incarceration, we have to get, you know, the profit motive out of incarceration.
I also want to make clear that LB and I really, I think, don't disagree on this issue, which was the beginning of that question. And her book is wonderful, and it looks in a practical way at these existing huge corporations that are housing a couple of 100,000 people right now, and what sort of questions do we need to be asking them, and what sort of demands do we need to be making of them right now. So I think the book is extremely reasonable, accepting what exists right now. And you know, the stock prices of the private prison companies soared when Donald Trump was elected president. So there's no realistic possibility of getting rid of them next week. But on a philosophical level, I completely oppose them. And you know, mass incarceration, if mass incarceration is shameful, to me, this is one of the most shameful aspects of it.
I just wanted to give a reminder to those who are listening to this conversation on the podcast. We're talking about private prisons with NYU Law School's Brennan Center for Justice, and you're joined by Eli Hager, Eric Schlosser, Leo Cumberbatch, and Lauren Brooke Eisen. I'm Elsa Chang. You can follow NYU Law School's Brennan Center for Justice on Facebook and Twitter, and check out their videos and other podcasts on the website, brennancenter.org. All right, thank you. That was just a little commercial break there. I want to go to Eli now. Actually, this is really for Eli and LB. This is the question of access. I'm so fascinated, as a reporter, how you guys got access into, in your case, Eli, you know, these private transport companies, how did they even let you on the bus? How did that negotiation go? Did you have to agree to certain conditions?
They didn't let us on the bus.
Wait, so how did you know any of this? You just were interviewing people who had prisons.
LinkedIn has a surprising number of former prisoner transport guards. We talked to more than 50 people who had formerly worked for these companies who were on LinkedIn, although we found some on Facebook as well. And then they would, once you had talked to a few, they would identify other people who would be willing to talk to us. Actually, what we found was that a lot of these former employees of these companies were very willing to talk to us because they were also victims of these companies to a certain extent. They had been very poorly paid. They had been forced to drive these long trips, like I was describing before, without any sleep, which was another part of what caused all those crashes. And so they were very eager to talk to us, which was kind of shocking for people who report on criminal justice to have people who are in law enforcement talking openly about their work. It's unusual. But that's what we found in this particular case. And that was kind of our way in. I mean, we also relied a lot on lawsuits, so there's been so many lawsuits against these companies, especially federal lawsuits, which are available on PACER, and you can just look up the lawsuits and you can access all the depositions and documents that were involved in those lawsuits. So there's a number of ways to triangulate and gain access. And then at the end, they talked to us because we had so much damning information about them. They had to give their point of view. But no, they didn't let us on the vans. The only time we got a photograph of some of the vans was because one of the former officers said that he had a decommissioned van that he knew where it was. It was like at an automotive repair shop, and so he showed us the van.
Okay.
But no, they didn't cooperate.
That's fascinating. LinkedIn. All right, it is useful for something. Oops. Okay. How about you, LB? How did you get access into these private prisons that you visited?
It was very difficult. And
how did you pitch it? Like, I'm writing a book. I'm a lawyer.
I tried a lot of different things.
Yes.
At one point, you know, I sort of said I'm studying the issue. I did have one pretty high level official at CoreCivic. Spoke to me for 45 minutes, spoke about grandchildren and New York and a lot of things, and he thought I was a student doing a research project. And when he found out what I was doing, what I was researching, he said, oh, I'm not allowed to talk to you. You have to call my PR person. I said, I called your PR person. So I write about it all, I sort of lay it all out in the book. It was very difficult. Interestingly enough, I was able to gain access to the private prisons. These are state private prisons and federal immigration detention centers that were owned and operated by private corporations through the government. I was never able to gain access through Geo Group and CoreCivic, the two largest prison corporations that actually own the facilities. I tried, I recount it all here. I have, you know, emails back and forth. I even at one point sent an email to CoreCivic with a list of questions. How have you innovated? Please tell me, send me reports. You know, what are your best facilities? Can I go visit the facility that you think is better than any government prison? And they kept saying, well, get back to me. You know, they never responded. So interestingly enough, I visited some immigration detention centers in the summer of 2016, I think. And it was under the Obama administration. I was able to gain access through ICE, not through the corporations themselves. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I visited prisons in New Mexico and Colorado, and I was always able to gain access through the Director of Corrections, who, you know, they were always fine. They said, come on down, I'll take you to some government prisons and private prisons. And interestingly enough, just one anecdote, when I went to Colorado, the Director of Corrections took me to a private prison sort of on the border of Colorado and New Mexico, and the town, I think about, you know, 1,500 people live in this town, and the CEO of CoreCivic and a couple people from the PR team were actually there waiting for me in the conference room, even though they hadn't invited me in, they
right.
knew I was coming.
Yeah.
So, you know, similarly to Eli, and I know Eric is also gaining access himself to some of these facilities, trying to... it's very difficult, and that's a big problem. Prisons, jails, immigration detention centers are really big black boxes. There's so much that happens behind those bars that we do not know about. When we talk about private companies owning and operating these prisons and detention centers, we know a lot less.
Why do you think government officials are more receptive to opening their doors than private companies?
Well, partly they're required to, or they're subject to open disclosure laws, and at the federal level, they're, you know, subject to a lot of federal open records requests and FOIA. But I think, you know, they're career corrections people, and most of the directors of corrections who I've met in this country, they are there to provide safe and secure facilities and to rehabilitate people. You know, they want you to come in and see that sometimes they're proud of their work, they're proud of their programming. The private corporations are just much more closed systems.
And they're not subject to Freedom of Information Act searches.
Yeah.
And they've refused, not only they won't let me in, they won't speak to me on the phone. Like LB, they've asked that all questions be submitted by email. And it's quite unsettling to think that you can be tried and convicted by the government and then handed over to a private corporation that's going to be incredibly secretive about the conditions of your confinement, and then when they're challenged, say that it's trade secrets, that
right.
it's, you know, corporate policy. And there's, you know, you could make an argument that private companies maybe could build prisons, but they're run by public officials. But it's quite extraordinary. It's almost like out of a dystopian science fiction film, especially this transportation stuff. That, you know, you're convicted under law, you're handed over to a corporation,
and
then
there's no accountability.
You vanish.
Yeah. Khalil, what role do you think formerly incarcerated individuals can play in helping reform and improve the private prison system? I guess, let me put it this way. Do you think policymakers are listening to what you have to say, what formerly incarcerated individuals have to say about the conditions that they suffered?
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think that as Khalil, I think that there are politicians and policymakers who would listen to me because of a title, or because I work at an organization that's well-respected, or because I come from a major metropolitan city, and so I'm kind of savvy with some understanding of the issues. But I think they're less inclined to listen to someone who was just released after serving 30 years from a state prison, whether it's private or public, and may not be as articulate as someone like me. Mm-hmm. And I say that not to hold me up, but to say that that I'm very aware that it is very easy to exceptionalize me. And that in and of itself is dangerous, because then we say, well, we can only listen to the formerly incarcerated people that talk well, or that present well, or that won't be angry at the fact that they just were convicted for a crime that they, again, may or may not have convicted. So I think it's important to start to answer that way. But I will say that across this field, in terms of criminal justice reform, there is more and more attention being paid to the fact that if we are going to have a movement around criminal justice reform, that there is an understanding that we have to empower the people who have the most to lose and therefore the most to gain by what we're actually talking about. We have to empower them in a way that doesn't tokenize them or exceptionalize them, but puts them in seats of power to lend their experience. An experience that may or may not come from a college education, experience that may or may not come from a degree of some sort, but experience that comes from the lived aspect of what it is that we're talking about. There are some people who can tell you backwards and forwards and upside down, inside out, about how bad policy really impacts their day-to-day living when you are in a jail or a prison. And that is something that I would argue and say that most policymakers, most, not all, are not able to articulate. They may be able to articulate the 10,000 feet in the air perspective of the policy,
yeah,
but not necessarily get into the nuance of how that actually plays out, because we all know for a fact that policy 10,000 feet in the air doesn't always translate that way on the ground. Yes, there is more,
yeah,
and more people paying attention, but I would argue and say that it needs to be more.
I don't know if you have any anecdotes you want to share, but I mean, people who have spent time in prison are in the best vantage point to comment on what the conditions were like, how best can be improved, what their experience was after prison, how were they prepared during prison to experience and tackle challenges outside of prison. And then do you get the sense that policymakers are aware of that very unique vantage point and take advantage and want to learn from you? Or do you have anecdotes where it's really like you feel voiceless sometimes,
yeah,
or you are a cliche in their heads, and
mm-hmm,
right, you're tokenized,
yeah,
to use,
yeah,
one of your words.
I mean, I would say that at the organization that I work at, the Fortune Society, that we are a direct service organization. We service about 7,000 men and women annually, leaving systems, jail and prison amongst them. But we look at folks, we look to those folks to hear about what's happening on the ground, because they have a level of urgency. These are people that generally have left some jail or prison less than 72 hours after they walk into our doors. And so they have a on-the-ground perspective. And so as someone who runs the policy and advocacy wing, I can talk about my incarceration, I can talk about my reentry, but I understand that I've been given access to exceptional opportunities. And so, and the fact that I've been out more than 7 years. And so my perspective about the issues are not that close. And so we look to those folks to create a space, whether it's in testimony or whether it's in gatherings like this, to have folks come and tell their stories about what their experience was. And again, it doesn't always translate to be, you know, in ways that are favorable for some folks to hear. Because quite honestly, sometimes people just need to use profanity. People just need to say that the system is fucked up. And that's the best way that I can describe it. And I'm sorry if I offended everyone, anyone, but that is the reality.
Podcast.
Right? And so, yeah, totally aware of that. And so, you know, that is the space that we create, and we accept everything that comes with that. And so we do that for everything from local policy issues, whether it's here in the city, on a state level or even on a federal level?
Well, I definitely want to leave enough time for questions. We have about 15 minutes or so. Let's just go. Yes,
so should I use a mic or no?
What do you guys think? Audio team, mic? Yeah, we need a mic. So can someone run
there's
a mic?
Mic right there.
Oh, should we maybe have people step
want
up?
Want me to walk over here?
Yeah, maybe we should have the mic centrally located. Oh, that's as good as we can.
Okay.
Sorry
about
that.
Yeah. No problem.
Yes, my name is Christopher Ricciola, and sir, I know you were mentioning they wouldn't allow you into prison. I worked as a correctional officer in one of the most dangerous prisons in the United States, Garner Correctional, which is a psychiatric prison, gang prison in Newtown, Connecticut. Before that, I worked for Department of Mental Health, Fairfield Hills. I'm a direct witness of sexual assaults, where I served as a witness with the state to protect patients, inmates in the prison system. And basically what I'm going to state here, this is modern day slavery, as far as with the privatized prisons. And in the state prisons and the federal prisons, they do get a living wage. I mean, we were told by our union reps, put in 20 years, last 2 years, flood it with overtime, $6,000 for the rest of your life, guaranteed every month. And that's reality. In the privatized prisons, they're underpaid. I'm a member of the Southern Poverty Law Center. We're working on closing and ending privatized prisons. Again, I'm basically bringing forth here, and I'm asking you whether you agree or not agree. This is modern day slavery. Another consequence of this is when you become a felon, you can't vote. And I brought that out to Attorney Morris Steeves. There's another consequence that occurs with this. So it's very bad. It costs more money to keep a person in prison than to send them to Yale University. Governor Malloy, Governor Cuomo are working on closing prisons down because they said, we're not in the business of employment here. You're going to bankrupt our states. Do you agree that education is our key and that this is modern day slavery?
Is that?
To whoever on the panel.
Yes and yes. I agree that this is a way that when you create a system that requires bodies, people to exist in those systems, the system will find a way to put people in those systems. And so, and in terms of your second question, I believe that education is one of the keys that can help give someone empowerment. Yes, I do, because the first time that I sat in a college classroom was in a maximum security prison. The first time that I was given an A on a college paper was in a maximum security prison. The first time that I believed that I could actually do college successfully, that I could actually participate academically and do it successfully, was in a maximum security prison. Now, I'm not saying that to say, or to have my words misconstrued, to say that somehow prison saved my life. Because I think people hear that and they say, well, see, education works, so just give it to them while they're locked up. No, the reality is that at 21 years old, I was given an 11-year sentence. So that's a prison sentence that was more than half of my life I had lived up until that point. And what would have been true justice if the judge would have said, here is someone who has a tremendous amount of resources, access in the community, and seems like someone who's at the precipice of entering into adulthood in a way that could be productive to society. Yes, he made a mistake, and yes, he committed a robbery, but how about I give you a year? How about then your next court date, you come back in 1 year, and in that time, you should have enrolled in college, you should come back and be able to show me that you have been enrolled in college and that you're actively participating in college. Now, that may sound like there are some people who hear that and say, there's no way that a judge would do that. And you're right, there is no way that a judge would do that, because that's not what the system tells them that they have the ability to do. The judge's only question to himself was, how much punishment am I going to give this kid? Not if punishment or if prison was going to be the issue, but how much? How much time is actually justified here? And that in and of itself is one of the problems with our criminal justice system. So yes and yes.
Thank you, sir.
Next question.
We have a roving mic too.
Yeah.
This is
for MLB or I guess for anyone. There's a whole cottage industry of, on Wall Street of financing these private prisons. You know, there's research analysts at all the big banks that cover these private prisons. And did you talk to those people or have any of them had access? What do you think about the whole financing infrastructure? And, you know,
sure, I can start, and you know, if others have had experience with this as well. I did speak to a lot of analysts who cover the industry. It's interesting, I spoke to one on the heels of the presidential election when most people thought Hillary Clinton would be elected president, and he said, you know, even when Hillary's president, we're still going to see these private prisons. We're not going to see this huge reduction that everyone's talking about. You know, for those who followed her campaign donation, she was actually, she gave back all her campaign donations to the private prison industry at one point because she came under fire from Black Lives Matter and Bernie Sanders, who had never taken money. So I did speak to a lot of analysts who cover the industry. Most of them sort of call these corporations, you know, private prison REITs, which they are. The two biggest private prison corporations, CoreCivic and Geo Group, are real estate companies, essentially. They're REITs, and they get a pretty decent tax benefit from being REITs. So that seems to be where these companies are going in the future. They're moving more into owning and building real estate. You know, they now are diversifying and reading the tea leaves on sentencing reform, and that's what a lot of the analysts are also backing up. As states are starting to decarcerate, a lot of these corporations are diversifying in terms of owning drug treatment centers, you know, the real estate of that, and the you know, getting paid for the people who use those facilities. They're also diversifying internationally in Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, building and buying more real estate there. And then obviously immigration detention is something that all the analysts will talk about as well. I did speak to a lot of very smart tax attorneys to help me understand the whole REIT process as well, because that's pretty important in terms of how these corporations have been able to sustain themselves, you know, through the tax benefits of being a REIT. They've transformed a little bit.
I think one thing to add just from the economic point of view is that when the industry began in the 1980s and when they've talked about taking over the correctional system of Tennessee, they've talked about taking over the correctional system of Florida and Arizona, they made arguments that they could do an even better job with maximum security prisons and medium security prisons. But as they gained more and more experience in running these facilities, they realized that by far the most profitable people to lock up are immigrant detainees, because they're not violent. They're often women and children. They don't have to provide any kind of rehabilitative programming, education, and they can provide minimal health care. And because these detainees are undocumented immigrants, they're the most vulnerable and least likely and least able to complain about the conditions of their incarceration. So this is the best way to make money in the private prison industry imaginable. And that's why they've moved into it so aggressively. And our current president is going to give them an enormous amount of business.
And if I can just add, if I can just be clear again to my earlier point that the conversation tonight is largely around private prisons, but even in the New York State prison system, CoreCraft is the profiteering wing of the New York State Department of Corrections. And there are other entities similar to that across the country. And so what that means is that, yes, we don't want that to get lost in the conversation, that there are companies that are making a lot of money off of public entities that house people who have been convicted of felonies and misdemeanors.
Okay, we have 5 minutes left, so maybe two more questions?
How
about you? Oh, okay. Sorry, go ahead.
Good evening. I was wondering if you looked into one way of I guess starting to maybe control or bring into some kind of realm of culpability or accountability the contracts that the government enters into with these corporations. Isn't that a way of getting into some semblance of accountability by just inserting the contractual terms of what needs to be done and what levels of standards need to be met? And has that been done, and did you look at the contracts?
I swear I did not plan this question. I've never met you. Yes, so the book's ultimate recommendations focus on rewrite, literally tearing up the contracts that exist today and rewriting all contracts that government engages in with the private sector for private prisons and immigration detention centers. The contracts today treat the private sector as if they're government partners, and we need to treat them as if, you know, they're the private sector running and operating these prisons, and they need to innovate, they need to do more. So the book has a lot of recommendations about how to make change through contracts, to require transparency requirements, to require open access to journalists, families, you know, stakeholders, to require recidivism reduction rates, to require certain programming, and how that gets done. One of the key ways is to increase the fines for these corporations. So I visited a private prison in New Mexico, and the week after I visited, the monitor who worked at the prison sent me the letter he sent to CoreCivic, fining them $24,000 for a whole host of violations, including not releasing incarcerated individuals who were way past their release date. $24,000 is not a lot. They were short on staff, they were keeping incarcerated individuals too long, there were a bunch of other violations. We need to increase those fines, and that's a huge way to hold corporations accountable.
And you got the last question.
I don't think this is on. Is it?
Yeah, you are.
Okay, so the question is about the financing of private prisons, and aren't they publicly traded corporations? Are the REITs and the stock ending up in the portfolios of our public employee pension funds, and what leverage could be brought on these companies and insisting on disclosure under SEC and other requirements?
So New York City and Philadelphia have both divested. The pension funds have divested from the private prison industry, so if you had a New York City pension, it's now free of the private prison corporation. Those are the only two city pension funds that have started to do so, but there's a lot of momentum. There's a chapter in the book on divestment. Universities, Columbia University has started to divest. I think they might have completed their divestment already. So it's definitely a moment where this is forefront in a lot of city planners' minds and a lot of comptrollers' minds. But it's very complicated. Most university endowments are sort of interlocked with the private prison corporations because it's complicated, right? It's not just investing in these big corporations. It's that, you know, there's so many different funds that these corporations are part of. I don't know if you've looked into this, but it's very complicated. But there's a huge divestment movement right now, and New York City and Philadelphia are leaders on that.
And whether the divestment is effective at economically harming the private prison companies, it certainly is a way of stigmatizing them and bringing attention to their practices in the same way that divesting from companies that were doing business with South Africa and during the apartheid era is effective. Mm-hmm.
And I would also add to that that you can also play a role in that. I mean, I think it's one thing to look to the panel for ideas and direction, but everyone in this room could play a role in divestment by asking your pension fund or any other entity, whether it's a school that you go to, what is their position on private prisons? Do they receive money, whether it's from the private prison directly or through a hedge fund, as LB mentioned? But again, like, we are who we've been waiting for. And if we're waiting for someone to come in and save us, the reality is we're going to be waiting for a very long time, and that we all play a role in that. And so maybe that answer is not directed towards you, but I think someone in this room needs to hear that, that it's not just the panel that are going to come up with these solutions or authors of books, but that there's everyone is going to play a role with that, just like we've all played a role in getting us here.
All right, that wraps up our panel. I want to thank Eli.